Hey, it's Craig. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to Canadian History X early and ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime. Hey everyone, Craig Baird here. Before I begin today's story, I want to take a moment and ask that you check me out on Patreon at www.patreon.com/CanadaEHX. There are several tiers with great benefits, from ad-free content to t-shirts and other cool stuff. And if you're a fan of Canadian History X, make sure you check out my other shows, From John to Justin and Canada, A Yearly Journey. And don't forget, you can also donate directly to the show at www.canadaehx.com. It helps keep this show going. All right, on with the show.
A listener's note. The following episode contains coarse language, adult themes, and content of a violent and disturbing nature, and may not be suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised.
Joseph Montferrand stood on Sapper's Bridge, which connected the two areas of Bytown, Upper Canada. He was a hero to the French-Canadian workers he sought to protect, and he was the sworn enemy of the Shiners, a gang that ruled Bytown. In front of him were 150 members of that gang who were ready to take him down. One man against a sea of Shiners, throwing a fist in an epic battle. His great strength allowed him to knock several men off the bridge with one punch, and in the end he stood victorious and supreme as dozens of the Shiners lay on the bridge, bruised and beating at his feet. Or at least, that's what the legends say. I'm Craig Baird, and this is Canadian History X. Long before Ottawa was the capital of Canada, with majestic parliament buildings looking over the Ottawa River, it was a rough and tumble place called Bytown. And surrounding Bytown was an immense forest where the trees rose 100 feet in the air. White and red pines, along with spruce, hemlock, oak, and maple, all provided ample wood for Bytown. And to understand the tall tale and folk hero Joseph Montferrand, and how he came to fight the Shiners, who indeed caused death and mayhem for a brief period in the 1830s, I need to give you a brief background on timber. The timber history of the area began on June 11, 1806, when Philemon Wright, his son Tiberius, London Oxford, Martin Ebert, and John Turner left nearby Wrightstown with 700 logs and 6,000 barrel staves on a large raft on the Ottawa River. It took them 35 days to reach Montreal, and the journey was anything but easy. To get beyond the Long Sault Rapids, once located east of Cornwall but now long gone due to damming, the raft had to be broken into cribs and transported over land. The 300-kilometer trip was fraught with danger, and at one point the raft came apart, adding 2 months of repairs to the trip. And the delay in reaching Quebec City caused Philemon to miss his contract. But due to a French emperor running his armies around Europe, that delay turned out to be fortunate, and it altered the history of Ottawa and Canada forever. In 1806, French Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte ordered a blockade of the Baltic Sea in the hopes of bringing Britain to its knees during the Napoleonic Wars. Almost all the timber Britain used came from the Baltic countries and the United States, but tensions were growing between the United States and Britain, which would culminate in another war half a decade later. As a result, Britain looked to its colony, Canada, and its vast forests. The arrival of timber in Quebec City could not have come at a better time, and Philemon was able to sell his timber not to the French, but instead to eager British buyers. And after he returned home, he put all his efforts behind the Ottawa Valley timber trade. And as he made money, others sought to do the same, and timber companies sprang up around the area. The importance of the Ottawa River increased as timber trade grew. Then came the War of 1812. From 1812 to 1815, war raged between the United States and Britain. The United States planned to invade Upper Canada from New York by following the St. Lawrence River. If the Americans were successful, Montreal would be cut off from the naval base in Kingston. Thankfully, the war ended with neither side gaining any ground. And after the war was over, the British government decided they needed to ensure safe passage between Montreal and Kingston in the event of another war. This necessitated a new route north along the Ottawa River to the mouth of the Rideau River, southwest via canals to Kingston and to Lake Ontario. The last portion of this route would become the Rideau Canal. Construction on the canal began in 1826 under the supervision of Lieutenant Colonel John Bye of the Royal Engineers. For the previous two decades, Bye had distinguished himself for his work building fortifications in Quebec City and improving the navigation of ships along the St. Lawrence River. With his expertise, the British felt he was the perfect man to oversee the construction. Now, with the huge project of the Rideau Canal on the go, thousands of Irish, Scottish, and French-Canadian laborers came to the Ottawa Valley to work. And work on the canal started in the fall of 1826. With so many people in the area working, a small community sprang up. Stores catering to the workers appeared, schools to educate their children were built, and homes were constructed. And rather than have a community that was built in a haphazardly manner with winding and confusing streets, Colonel Bye laid out the streets in this new community in an orderly manner. Wellington, Sussex, and Sparks Streets were the earliest streets built, and where Parliament Hill now sits, that was once called Barracks Hill. The west side of the community became known as Upper Town and was populated by Irish Catholic immigrants. The east side of the community was known as Lower Town and was populated by French Canadians. The two sides were connected by Sapper's Bridge, now known as Plaza Bridge. The new community needed a name, and Bytown was chosen in honor of Colonel Bye, the man who built the canal. On May 22, 1832, Colonel Bye and his family left on a ship from Kingston and arrived in Bytown 7 days later using the canal he had constructed. He then returned to England and never again visited the community that was named for him. The end of the canal construction brought on another, much more dangerous era for Bytown. The era of the Shiners. With the canal completed, the timber trade continued to be the main employer of the area, and that attracted more entrepreneurs who built their own sawmills and timber companies. Then came Peter Aylin. In 1835, he decided he was going to control the timber trade through violence and mayhem. Now, little is known about his life prior to his arrival in Bytown, but we do know he was born in Liverpool in 1799, and according to legend, he was a runaway sailor who changed his name. After he arrived in Bytown and started working in the timber trade, Aylin began to show his immense ambition and that he was prepared to do anything he could to control the timber market of the Ottawa Valley. Prior to the completion of the Rideau Canal, he raided the timber claims of his competitors, destroyed their rafts, and, in a sign of things to come, attacked other timber crews with his own crews. There was a lot of money to be made, and to put it into perspective, a raft from Bytown to Quebec City had 2,000 to 2,400 timbers on it worth $12,000. Adjusted for inflation, that's worth $400,000 today. And after the Rideau Canal was completed, Aylin put himself forward as a champion of the unemployed Irish. He began to recruit them into his service to help grow his timber business even further. He also created an enemy for the Irish, the French-Canadian timber workers, who were also unemployed and competing for jobs. Aylin told his supporters that they were the ones taking their jobs. Thanks to his shady and violent business tactics, Aylin quickly controlled the timber along the river by 1835. That's when he turned his sights on a new target, Bytown. Aylin sought to control it with a group of 200 Irishmen who adopted the name of Shiners, and he took control of Lower Town. Now, the origin of the group's name is relatively unknown. One possibility is the French word chêneur, which means cutter of oak trees. Another possibility is from the phrase shine above others. And a third possibility is it came from the shiny coins the members were paid in by Aylin. Regardless, almost as soon as the Shiners appeared, Bytown was less a quiet frontier town and more a Gangs of New York crime-infested locale. In July 1835, Aylin was arrested for assault for the first time. The British Whig and General Advertiser for Canada West stated on June 12, 1835, "The account of the troubles in Bytown, contained in the Montreal Gazette, is incorrect. It seems Peter Aylin, a gentleman of large property near Bytown and a friend to the poor man, thought proper to inflict a tremendous horsewhipping on D. McMartin, an attorney of Perth, who it is said richly deserved it." His shiners quickly went on a rampage, destroying a canal steamer in the harbor. At this point, Aelin was released, and the lack of consequences for his actions showed others in the community that he was now untouchable. And while the Shiners started by attacking French-Canadian timber workers, they soon expanded their victim base. Murder, assault, and arson were not out of bounds for them. At one point, they beat a farmer's pregnant wife with sticks as she rode by on a sleigh. She jumped out, but her dress became caught in the sleigh and she was dragged along the frozen ground before getting free. The reason? She was the wife of a farmer named Hobbs, who had offended the Shiners in some unknown way. The Shiners were known to pollute wells, kidnap children and throw them far away from home in the snow for them to run back, shatter windows, and on one occasion they broke up a funeral procession and threw the coffin off the hearse and into the street, simply because they could. When Joseph Galipeau, who owned a Lower Town tavern, which was frequented by French-Canadian raftsmen, fired a shot at one of the Shiners during a fight, they went to the magistrate, who happened to be Irish and a friend of Aelin. Galipeau was jailed for assault, and while he was incarcerated, the Shiners burned his tavern to the ground. At other taverns, the Shiners would go in as a large group armed with clubs and force the owner to supply them with liquor for free. They then got drunk and trashed the tavern before moving on to the next one. Father Alexis de Barbazeau, an area priest, said, "There is no God in Bytown." It was not unusual for someone to go to Bytown for work and then to never be heard from again. In the 1800s, it was said that if you crossed the bridge over the Ottawa River, you could hear the haunting cries of drowned French-Canadian workers in the water below. Now, special constables were hired to deal with the problem, but they were quickly paid off by Aelin to look the other way. And even if someone pursued the Shiners, they just ran over the bridge into Lower Canada where they could evade arrest. The fact Bytown had no courthouse or jail further complicated things, and most officers simply didn't want to travel 75 kilometers to the nearest jail in Perth, and it was easier to just let the gang members go. Even those who were not on the payroll were powerless. In August 1835, when a constable went to arrest a Shiner who attacked some residents, one Shiner took the gun straight out of his hand and beat the constable with it, while the other Shiners jumped on him. Now, the wealthy elite of Bytown simply didn't care too much about the Shiners because they were left alone, as the street warfare was confined mostly to Lower Town. Slowly, though, things began to change. Farmers were reluctant to go into Bytown to buy or sell provisions. They instead chose to go a longer distance to another, safer town. This caused the merchant class to wake up and see the issue. Then, in August 1835, Aelin made the first move that caught the notice of Bytown's elite. He took over the Bathurst District Agricultural Society, which was the pinnacle of society in Bytown at the time. In a move that would be replicated by comic book villains decades later, Aelin had his men pay the $1 membership fee, overwhelming the authentic members of the society, who then voted in Aelin and his supporters as directors. Now, despite the violence that the Shiners had conducted over the previous few years, this was the tipping point for the elites. On October 20, 1835, the Association of the Preservation of the Public Peace was formed to combat the violence. With guns provided by town magistrates, the organization formed the Bytown Rifles. Unfortunately, no one liked the commander of the force, Captain Baker, and they soon disintegrated. At this point, those weapons fell into the hands of vigilantes who tried to maintain order with limited success against the Shiners. In March 1836, the Ottawa Lumber Association was established to stop the violence in the timber trade. Aelin became one of its first officers. And while this may seem like an odd turn of events, Aelin had gained all he could from controlling the river and timber trade, and he was now focused on being the man about town. Plus, joining the organization benefited his business. The first act of the association was improving the movement of timber on the Madawaska River, where Aelin had operations. Aelin now found he could make money by influencing politics without the need for violence. Nonetheless, that wouldn't stop the violence in Bytown. The French Canadians had rallied around their own leader amid this violence. And now, we're at the beginning of the episode and the story of Joseph Montferrand, defender against the Shiners. French Canadians now had their own comic book hero. He was born on October 25, 1802 in Montreal and arrived in Bytown in the 1820s to work in the timber camps. Montferrand's stories say he was a hero for sure. Since then, something of a legend has sprung up, but The story started because he was a champion bare-knuckle boxer who often fought English opponents and used his skills to defend French Canadians in bars and in the streets. In 1832, during a violent by-election in Montreal, he fought off a group of attackers who were threatening his friend Antoine Voyer. Another story tells of how he could put a heel mark on a tavern ceiling with a somersault, or could lift a plow out at arm's length with one hand. Now, regardless of the tall tales, Montferrand did defend his French-Canadian timber workers against the Shiners throughout the 1830s in Bytown, and thus further cemented his legacy as a folk hero in Quebec. The worst year for violence was 1837. The town council election was disrupted by the Shiners, and Aylin was elected as one of the three councillors. He then demanded that the other positions be filled by his supporters, and 60 men stormed the meeting room to back him up. James Johnson, a local newspaper editor, was beaten with sticks and horsewhips at the meeting. It ended with legitimate attendees fleeing and Aylin now in control of the political affairs of Bytown. I know, it sounds like something out of Gotham City. Then 10 days later, an inquiry was held and nearly every witness blamed Aylin for the council affair. Aylin and his men did not testify at the inquiry, and it was determined by the inquiry magistrates that a proper municipal police force was needed, as well as a jail and courthouse. But still, the reign of terror continued. In late February 1837, the Shiners took a local indigenous man, beat him, and threw him out a window. Several people rushed him to a doctor, but he died within hours. A week later, a man named Scarf was dragged from his sleigh, had his shoulder dislocated, head cut in three places, and was badly beaten. That same evening, the Shiners robbed a man of $30. The British Whig wrote on March 7, 1837. We learn by gentlemen who has recently visited Bytown that the outrages of a most brutal nature are of frequent occurrence in that place and its neighborhood, the work of a set of men called Shiners. As for poor James Johnson, he was a constant target for the Shiners. He owned the Bytown Independent and Farmers Advocate, which reported on the Shiners' crime spree. In March 1837, armed men went into his house and shot off guns in his home. The newspaper stated on March 22, 1837, a band of desperados, armed with guns, came in front of the dwelling house of Mr. James Johnson, Bytown, and demanded the body of a person supposed by them to be concealed there. On being informed by Mr. Johnson that there was not in or about his premises, several shots were fired through the windows of the upper story. Now, no one was hurt, but a short time later, Johnson was ambushed on the bridge by three men, Thomas Burke, Patrick O'Brien, and James McDonnell, with guns and whips. Johnson saved himself by jumping off the bridge into the snow, but he suffered a fractured skull. The three men who attacked Johnson were captured and taken to Perth to stand trial. Aylin broke them out of prison, but they were recaptured later in the year and sentenced to 3 years of hard labor. As it turned out, terrorizing Johnson proved to be the Shiner's undoing. Johnson wrote to Lieutenant Governor Sir Francis Bondhead stating, Mr. Peter Aylin has already proved to all Bytown that he neither respects himself nor fears God or man. The laws are like cobwebs to him. There are now several warrants out for his apprehension, but there's not a constable in Bytown who will undertake to arrest him. At this point, Bytown citizens were becoming more organized. Armed night patrols were formed and special constables were sworn in to arrest lawbreakers. And through determined action, the Shiners were brought under control between April and May 1837. With the Shiners becoming powerless, Aylin found himself on the receiving end of threats. On May 9, 1837, a man named Murphy went into a store where Aylin was and unleashed a torrent of verbal abuse against him, then drew two loaded pistols and threatened to shoot him before he was restrained by others. At this point, Aylin saw that his time as the top dog in Bytown was over. He leased out most of his property, which included 150 acres along Richmond Road that contained a two-story house, barns, stables, a blacksmith shop, and a store. He also sold a 300-acre lot and 12 10-acre woodlots. He also leased out his own Bytown home and store, along with another 250 acres of land. He then moved across the river to Lower Canada. Now, without Aylin financing and leading them, the Shiners disbanded, and the gangs of New York era of Bytown ended. It was time for a new, more peaceful chapter to begin. But what happened to Aylin after he left Bytown?
Bytown.
After Aylin moved across the Ottawa River near Sims Landing, he bought a farm and continued to operate a timber business. Either wanting to repent for his past transgressions or scared of being arrested, Aylin turned over a new leaf. A year after he moved in 1838, he was one of four trustees who built a church in the settlement. In 1846, he became a member of the Hull Township Council, by legitimate means this time, and a year later was the assessor for Sims Landing. In 1848, in a wild turn of events, he was appointed as the Justice of the Peace. And Aylin's children turned out to also be respectable citizens. One became a doctor, another became a lawyer, and a third became a doctor and a lawyer. His descendants would include Aldous Aylin, who was appointed to the Supreme Court of Ontario in 1950. But a leopard can't change its spots, and a tiger cannot change its stripes. In Aylin's case, his return to villainy was relatively minor. In 1851, his timber limits were confiscated by the Crown's Land Office because he failed to pay his dues, and he conducted some unspecified illegal proceedings. And Aylin died around October 1868, long enough to see the town he terrorized become the capital of a brand new country called Canada. I hope you enjoyed that episode. Information from Canadian Encyclopedia, Biography, Historical Society of Ottawa, Wikipedia, Run Ottawa, Logging in the Ottawa Valley, British Wigan General Advertiser for Canada West, and the Montreal Gazette. This show is researched, produced, and written by me, Craig Baird, with the help of Dila Velasquez. Audio production and design by Rosalind Kufor. If this is your first time listening and you like what you heard, please take a moment and give us a 5-star review to help other people find these amazing stories. And there are so many for you to sink your teeth into. If you enjoy this podcast, then please check out my other podcasts, From John to Justin, Canada, A Yearly Journey, Pucks and Cups, and Canada's Great War. We love hearing from you, so if you have a show topic you want me to cover, email me at craig@canadaehx.com, or stop by my website and social media. I'll include all of those in my show notes. Until next time, I'm Craig Baird, and this is Canadian History X.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his 6-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his 2-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.